Dick. I have two redheads in the family, by the way, Will. My wife and Julie are both redheads. However, Julie now is a blackhead because she has dyed her hair and doesn't want to know from it, but she is naturally a redhead. But, and all kidding aside, I found for, okay, the open wire feeders, something that, well, how did they say, let me let it drop?
One other thing, Mel, is your transmitter running in the higher power mode? A little bit of hiss in the background, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I forgot, I have it down low because, wait a minute, hold on. Okay, that's better, I forgot, I turned the amp on. You know, I'm usually doing local communications here, so usually I can get down to a few watts and it'll be more than adequate. As I said, when it came to, like, the loop antenna, what is old is new again, because the loop antenna, basically, I'm using, you know, that link coupling, which I'm using a Johnson, old Johnson kilowatt matchbox. In fact, they're worth more now. When I see them advertised than they were when they were new. It is a great tuner. Too bad there isn't anybody interested in sort of manufacturing something like that, but I guess it maybe would be a little bit too much price-wise and wouldn't get enough attraction to go into the production of that type of a device. And if you, like I say, depends on, again, you made a good statement when you said the antenna. If you're going to go to an inverted L, well, I guess a simple old straightforward L network type of tuner. If you're going to a so-called balanced dipole or a beam or something on that sort, I guess you can't go wrong with a pi network. It's a very difficult, I could say, question, because you look on Smith chart, it goes some of the tutelages, let me let it drop. And you look at some of those tutelages, you see, as Dick said, it goes through just about the entire rotation of every kind of possible conjugate match. And this is a hard nut to crack. I never really looked into the automatic tuners and see really what are they based on, because they make claims on the automatic tuners, you know, that match just about everything, you know, remote systems and all, just hang it up there at the antenna. Of course, they will show you a very good SWR, so can we say that they're working properly? I guess we have to take their word for it. But there is no substitute for making measurements at the antenna, and sometimes a rude awakening, unfortunately. So I guess I don't know really how to answer the subject, except if you say for a general dipole, that seems to be the most popular antenna with new people coming into amateur radio, I would say you can't go wrong with that, like you said, that Pi network that seems to be very popular with the tuners, over.
Within the range that a Pi network will give you performance. In other words, in theory, I can take a Smith chart, I can color in a portion of the chart, starting at the center and going out to a particular radius, but it's not a pure circle, but there's a certain amount of area of the Smith chart where a Pi network will handle that. As you adjust the C1 and C2 capacitor, in some cases you've got a switch which adjusts the amount of inductance, it does give you a very good tuning, rather high efficiency, you've got good components, if you've got good components, across all of that area. And properly constructed, it will give you 99% efficiency, so to speak, and should it be automatic. And the good news about automatic is that you press the button and the motors turn and it arrives at a solution and you're there. There's a catch. I've heard a significant number of stories of people where at certain antennas, certain frequencies, certain impedances, the automatic function of the antenna tuner goes into a continuous search and never finds a solution, even though there really is a solution. In other words, you're not outside of the effective area, but it's just one of those magic phase angles and amplitudes of reflected signal from your particular antenna which sends your particular antenna tuner into a hang-up. Let me drop. The way an automatic antenna tuner works is a little bit like a sight-impaired person walking up a hill. By the tilt of the hill that he can feel with his feet, he knows which way is uphill, he knows which way to go, even though he's sight-impaired. An automatic antenna tuner measures the amplitude and the phase angle of the signal coming back from the antenna. That tells it whether or not the C1 capacitor of the Pi network should increase or decrease, and whether or not the C2 capacitor should increase or decrease, or whether or not it should switch to a slightly different inductor. Depending on how well it is programmed, in theory it should automatically come to the right solution, but sometimes it does not. So, if money was no object and you're willing to buy one with automatic function, I, for one, would like to make sure that the manufacturer gave me a manual override capability, that if it did go into one of these hang-up modes where it's searching forever and never found it, I'd like to be able to manually adjust those controls and get the best possible solution myself in those difficult circumstances. But that's just me. So choosing the best possible transceiver or transmitter-receiver rig, not easy. Mel and I would do it by going to a flea market or going to eBay or whatever, used equipment market, because we know we get a lot of bang for the dollar out of equipment that is well-respected because it's got a good track record, and you're buying it used. You save an awful lot of money. I don't have to have the absolute latest horns and whistles in the rig that I use, whereas a new person worries about the fact that, gee, somebody else used that rig and abused it. Well, the old-timer guys know that anything is fixable. Let me drop. When you got a guy like Andy, WA2CQL, in the club, who can fix anything, you don't worry about buying a rig as long as the box is not empty inside. As long as all the parts are there, everything is fixable with rare exception. So the possibility, the only real lemon you could ever get is the one lemon that I got once, which was a 432 all-mode rig where that particular production run of ICOM, they forgot to remove all of the wave solder flux. They didn't do a washing procedure, and therefore these active fluxes were slowly eating their way into all of the rotary bearings of all of the variable capacitors of that frequency synthesizer board. And there's about 15 of them there. And each of those 15 variable capacitors on that frequency synthesizer printed circuit board would randomly go open circuit or short circuited periodically. And so you bang your fist on the rig and you punch the buttons and whatever. Never twice on 2 days in a row did the rig act the same way. Very troublesome rig. That was a real lemon. And I went through the process of buying all those variable capacitors and replacing them. And that was a dog of a problem. And the job of washing the printed circuit board and getting rid of all that flux was not easy. And even the active flux was slowly eating its way through the plastic-cased integrated circuits and starting to create intermittent failures of those. So in that severe situation, that was a lemon. But a rig that's got a dented front panel and scratches on it because it's been thrown down a flight of stairs, Mel and I would use that to our advantage and bid a lower price on the rig, and we'd be happy to use it because we know we could fix it. So as you can see, there's many ways of solving the problem of the best rig and the best antenna tuner. There's no simple solution. The best I could recommend is study the subject, talk to people who you respect, see what they think is their favorite, and even if you buy one...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Even if you buy one that's less than optimum, there's nothing to say you've got to keep it forever. The nice thing about buying used equipment that has a good track record is that you use it for a year, you use it for 5 years, and if for some reason you want to trade up to something else, in the case of well-respected brand names and model numbers, you can usually get a high percentage of your investment back. And it comes out a pretty nice arrangement, if you know what I mean. I know we didn't give him an exact answer, Mel, but I think under the conditions, it may be the best we can do, but let me throw it open to the net. There's a lot of smart people in the New York City metropolitan area. When it comes to choosing a ideal antenna tuner, ideal meaning not one that'll break the bank, not one that'll fill up the whole shack, but one that's does the job reasonably well. What have you guys used for antenna tuners? How happy or unhappy are you with them? Give me your call letters right now if you've got an opinion on that subject. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul, and wait for the beep.
Okay, my automatic antenna tuner is actually inside the radio, as it came with 440S, and which has worked perfectly for almost perfectly for all these years since 1986. Once in a while, oh, maybe once every 6 months or so, or maybe once a year, I might go into this loop that you were talking about, Dick. But to get out of it, all I do is just change the frequency, or have an antenna switch. I'll just switch antennas. I'll hit that antenna tuner button again. It'll look for a completely different match, and only for a couple seconds. And then I'll switch back to the original frequency I was trying to get. Hit the antenna tuner again, and then that time it will find it. So that's how I get out of it anyway. But I mean, once in a blue moon. I mean, maybe I use this rig quite a bit, and you know, if it happens twice a year, I think it's a lot. Back to you, Dick.
And to give a visual representation of that, picture a sight-impaired person walking up a hill, and picture a hill that he's walking up having a small molehill on the side of it. In theory, he could get hung up on that little molehill, thinking that's the peak of the mountain, so to speak. And by the same token, depending on the design of your particular antenna tuner, if it's walking up a particular path from point A to point B, it could run into one of these ruts, so to speak, in its design program, where it goes into a search mode and never finds it. By Paul going over to a second antenna, which is the equivalent of walking over to the other side of the base of the mountain, and then going back up, the next time it takes the trip, it doesn't walk near that molehill, if you know what I mean. Electronically, there is something like that taking place. So depending on where you start from and where you're going to, some of those paths are successful and some of them are not so successful if your antenna tuner is less than ideal. The way the antenna tuner works is by measuring amplitude and phase, and there's always a certain amount of error in what it measures. So it can get into a hang-up mode. So by adding another random length of cable, by tuning to another antenna, tuning to another frequency, and then repeating the process, going back to the original, sometimes you'll find a solution. And having a manual override capability could be handy, in my opinion. Now, when it comes to antenna tuning, which really means you're correcting for a crazy impedance of an antenna that's not exactly 50 ohms resistive if you're using 50 ohm coaxial cable, I wonder if you've seen the September-October issue of QEX magazine, Mel, and saw the lead article on the subject of a simple path to complex impedance, and he doesn't say it, but it means simple path to complex impedance measurement. And on there, he's got on figuring up
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
On figure number five on page five, he's got this beautiful, what he calls bidirectional coupler. It is a return loss bridge made out of two transformers, 10-to-1 transformers. Wonder if you saw that beautiful schematic. And I did a little bit of study about that, and it's got some real nice characteristics. Wonder if you saw that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yes, I did. And has a lot of good things going for it. And I've more or less experimented along the same ideas. As far as automatic antenna tuners, I have to have one particular rig that has a very nice, supposedly was well recommended, built-in antenna tuner in the ICOM 765. What I noticed, in one time I had the radio part, and I noticed that it was continuously, very subtly hunting. In other words, it seems like I've looked at quite a number of antenna automatic antenna tuners make, all seem to have the same thing that if you measure the current that they're drawing at any one time, you'll see all of a sudden little peaks in the current drain. It seems like they are almost constantly hunting to some extent. Let me let it drop. I went ahead and I built a very sophisticated automatic antenna tuner and with servo motors and the whole bit. Put a lot of resources into building. It was based on that W8ZX I saved it in QST a number of years ago. He did a 2 month series on it, on that tuner, building that automatic tuner, and with manual tuning. And I find many times using that tuner that I let it go basically, you know, I basically let it go to the, you know, to the point where it's basically tuned to that particular antenna frequency, and then I switch it. You can touch it up then, of course. If you have two knobs, you have the knobs sticking out, three knobs sticking out. It's, but I notice this is a characteristic that many people, of course, do not know what's going on unless you really look into it. So, what can I say? it's tough to really to give a definite explanation on this particular subject thing. Over.
Where the antenna tuner is looking for the resultant reflected signal after it's done its tuning, and is trying to null that reflected signal out at the transmitter port. If the manufacturer hasn't declared a certain level of success, in other words, if the reflected signal is less than 0.05 of the voltage that went out, and it says that it'll stop tuning when it gets there, unless they've done something like that, it might continuously be in a search mode, a small error search mode, which may not be bad. I mean, if you've got an antenna that's a dipole in the trees and the wind is blowing and the antenna impedance is slightly changing and the antenna tuner is compensating for that, it could be good. Also, depending on how your antenna tuner really works, the fact that it's always hunting, if there was a slight scratchiness of the bearing of the variable capacitor, it could be transmitting some noise. So should you turn it off after it has arrived at what you believe is a good enough solution? There's ways you could modify the design so that it does its antenna tuning while you're doing a push-button operation, and then you stop doing the push-button, and the thing goes inert. There's ways you can get around that. You can make a modification like that if you think this is troublesome. If you were running on a battery-operated supply and you worry about wasting power running those motors and it doesn't really have to be done, that's another possible thing to consider. Let me drop. So, depending on your degree of exactness in your personality, whether or not that amount of searching that it might be taking place is a troublesome. I don't know. Not a clear one. By the way, when you study this Figure 5 in the latest issue of QEX Magazine, September-October 2010, you'll discover that each of those 10-to-1 transformers, one of them is measuring current, one of them is measuring voltage, and because of the 50-ohm standard resistors that are built into that, those two 50-ohm resistors on the sensing side are really 25 ohms when they're in parallel. A 10-to-1 turns ratio transformer, by definition, makes a 100-to-1 impedance transformation between primary and secondary winding. Therefore, the 25 ohms that's really on the secondary as a load to the current measuring transformer, T1, gets reflected into the primary as a 0.25 ohm series resistor. Therefore, that particular antenna tuner will only be balanced when you take out 0.25 ohms in the load. So you would like to believe that that thing is looking for a perfect 50 ohm load. It's looking for a perfect 49.75 ohm load, which is not bad. That's good enough. And if you really cared about that, you could take the 250 ohm resistors and make them 50.25 or 50.5, and the problem would go away. But the author of the article, I can tell, didn't sense that. When he tells you how well that bridge gives him a null, and the null was okay, but it could have been better had he realized that there's a slight error in that method of measurement. I won't call it error. It's got its own built-in offset, so to speak, which is calculatable and compensatable, if you care about that. The kind of fun things, the nice thing about these is that a directional coupler, let me drop, in past discussions with Wesley and 2XJN, we talked about a waveguide, a microwave type directional coupler, the Nodder brand one that's usually built with triplate strip line, which has a straight through piece of strip line, a parallel piece of strip line, which does the coupling, and typical couplers are 10 or 20 decibels of coupling coefficient at the design frequency. And as you go lower in frequency, the 10 dB of coupling goes to 15, 20, 25, 30, and so on. That a directional coupler goes down to much, much lower frequencies, a decade lower, maybe even two decades lower than the design frequency, and still gives a predictable performance, but it does it with a slight slant in the, a predictable slant in the coupling coefficient. And when you get down to a low enough frequency where it becomes a 75 or a 90 dB coupler instead of a 10 dB coupler, as long as the signal you're measuring is large enough, that's not a problem. But if it's not a large enough signal because you're a QRP operator, that could be a trouble if you're not willing to put in a preamplifier and so on your sensing circuit. Well, the schematic diagram is in the latest issue of QST Magazine. This thing is completely flat in its performance. As long as those individual transformers keep their 10-to-1 ratio and have no significant amount of stray inductance or stray capacitance, then this particular kind of reflection loss bridge, directional coupler, call it what you like, it's a lump circuit equivalent built with transformers or with toroid-like or regular transformers. This thing could work almost DC to light as long as the transformer still has operation at that frequency. This thing could work over a very large frequency region. That method, let me drop.
Got a comment on that.
I'm going to pass it over to you for the comment. I wouldn't use this technique much higher than 30 megacycles unless you are very careful with the design of the transformers. But as long as the transformer has proper performance down to, let me pick a number, 100 kilohertz, then I think that circuit could give rather good performance from 30 megacycles, a well-designed one, from 30 megacycles down to 100 kilohertz. That's a 300-to-1 frequency ratio, is a possibility in my mind. I wonder if you've ever built or used one of these, Mel. I wonder if you think it's very difficult to get transformers with that kind of performance. And what do you think about that overall schematic? K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Has a lot going for it, Dick, if you do a careful job. And yes, the transformers are a critical point of the whole circuit. The point is, what I've gotten, I meant to mention this a number of times, and I guess because we were on to other subjects. Do you remember some months ago, I came up with an idea, well, I came up with the idea many years ago, but I had brought up that situation where I showed you that I was making measurements by adding a 25-ohm resistor into the circuit and using a bridge to measure then the resistive and the reactive component. Do you remember that, over?
I sure do. And you and I had a discussion on that subject that went on for 2 or 3 weeks. And most of the time, I think it's a good approach. But I'm a little bit worried that for a person who's not quite as experienced as you using that technique, there's a chance he could get into a hang-up mode where he comes up with the wrong answer. It's not a perfect approach, in my opinion. There's a degree of ambiguity. With your experience, you know how to resolve the ambiguity. So the instructions that go along with that technique are kind of significant. My guess is when you tried to teach that technique to other people, I'll bet you've occasionally had some pushback on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Exactly, because a number of these handheld antenna analyzers, it made them show that they're inaccurate. So again, I said, listen, I don't know the individual, you know, antenna analyzer that well. You know, the only one I'm very familiar with is the AEA graphic analyzer, which I, of course, have the graphic display. It's a very sophisticated instrument as far as I'm concerned. For amateur radio, it's a little bit, I guess, a little bit overboard for most people. But, of course, with the software, I download it to my laptop and I can do a lot of analysis. But I've been able to confirm everything, more or less, with that method I was using, that there is, that it is accurate. Now, possibility, like you say, that you see, because the antenna analyzer is going through a whole, try to explain that, going through the whole Smith chart in a way, looking at a number of different situations, that which one is made, well, I almost said that, but I guess I shouldn't say that. Maybe the method that I was using is the definitive method correctly used, over.
Yeah, what you were doing, if I understand correctly, is you would take the load of the antenna as read by a antenna analyzer, and maybe it said 55 ohms at capacitive 5 ohms and 55 ohms of resistance. Then you plugged in a 25 ohm resistor in series with the antenna terminals, and you would like the resistive component to go up by 25 ohms, hopefully exactly, and no essential change to the capacitive component. You're doing a kind of a check of the accuracy of the antenna analyzer. And I think you're saying that quite a few of them under those conditions will not give results quite as desirable as you would like. And you got to worry a little bit about how did you plug in the 25 ohm resistor. Was it really a 25 ohm resistor at that frequency? Because every realistic resistor has got a little bit of series inductance of its leads, and it's got some straight capacitance across its body, and depending on how you mount it in the circuit, you could be adding some extra stray reactances. And you could also do a similar experiment by putting the instead of putting the resistor in series, by way of a T connector, it would be a lot easier to put the resistor in parallel and put, say, for instance, a 1,000 ohm resistor in parallel with the antenna. And for a guy that's pretty smart with calculations, calculating what the real impedance of the antenna is and what the result will be when you put another 1,000 ohm resistor in parallel with it, there's a fairly simple formula for doing that. Therefore, you can predict what the result should be and then find out if the antenna tuner is giving that result. So it's a beautiful way of giving a check of the accuracy in the impedance regions that you're using for your particular antenna with that particular antenna tuner. So I think that's part of what you were doing as a kind of a check. Is that true, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
To know a way that I could possibly use a generic, let's call it a generic way of determining without going through a lot of fancy electronics, you know, or manipulations. I just was doing a simple thing. I was basically reading a resistor. And that's it. Now I just want to determine now, simply, I get a reactance. Well, I put the variable, using a simple variable capacitor, then add it to the circuit. If the reactants, knowing that if I'm adding more capacitive reactants, and I see the condition, I know I'm, where I am, whether I'm minus or plus J. So it was very simple at that point, because, you know, you've got that ambiguity at that point, whether you're minus or plus J. And I think that a lot of times that if you're a borderline situation, I think that's where the inaccuracy comes in, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm going to give a little bit of an answer here now, a little bit of an explanation. For those who are listening, real impedances at RF frequencies can be represented as either a series equivalent circuit or a parallel equivalent circuit. Series equivalent is the most popular, but it's not the only way. And when you represent a true impedance of, say, an antenna or an antenna plus feed line in the series equivalent circuit, there's two numbers, a resistive number and a reactive number. The impedance, which is usually represented by the capital letter Z for zebra, equals R plus JX. R stands for the number of ohms of resistance, and JX, the X stands for the number of ohms of capacitive reactance, and the J represents the square root of minus one. Yeah, I know, it's an irrational number. That really is a fancy way of saying that the phase angle of the reactance is at right angles. If you made a diagram on a page, and a polar diagram, so to speak, no, it's a rectangular diagram, where left and right is the resistive component, and up and down is the reactive component, because you're using this XY chart, the reactive component being at right angles to the resistive component on that display is the reason they put that J in front. Positive J is up, negative J is down, but the fact that it's called J means it's at right angles to the resistance. So when any of us talk about the J component, we're talking about the amount of reactance, whether it be positive, which means an inductor, or negative, which means a capacitor, in the series equivalent circuit. And with a little bit of practice with so-called complex numbers, let me drop. With a little bit of practice with complex numbers, you'll eventually figure out how to manipulate these and how you can figure out what's happening with your particular return loss bridge, your particular antenna analyzer. And the best possible way of doing it, Mel, would be to have a real calibration kit. The calibration kit would consist of a known very high performance 50 ohm dummy load resistor. High performance meaning it's 50 ohms plus or minus a tenth of an ohm, and it acts that way whether you're at DC or 1 megacycle or 1,000 megacycles. And then you would have a perfect short circuit and a perfect open circuit, or a perfect capacitor of some particular value and a perfect inductor of some particular value. With a real calibration kit, you can test your antenna analyzer, and where Wesley right now owns a vector network analyzer, and it has a calibration procedure, the accuracy of the answers you're going to get out of a vector network analyzer can't be any better than the accuracy of your calibration kit. When you go through the calibration procedure on every reasonable vector network analyzer, you're teaching the machine how your particular piece of test cable, because the thing you're testing, rarely can you connect it directly to the front panel. You're usually connecting it through some length of cable, and every piece of cable has got its idiosyncrasies, it's got its characteristics. The input connector, the output connector, the cable itself, they have a kink in it, and some slight characteristics of the cable exist. By putting the short, open, and perfect dummy load at the far end of that cable, while you're going through the calibration procedure, you're teaching the vector network analyzer how its instrumentation, its test cable works, and by way of its memory and the so-called 12-point correction procedure, it cranks all of that back out, and therefore you can read exact
repeater, timeout, cancel.
And therefore you can read the exact impedance of your particular device on the test. What a lot of people don't realize is that if you really care about measuring your antenna itself, we all talk about the ideal situation of putting the antenna analyzer right at the top of the tower. Well, if it's a broadcast situation and you've got 300 feet of tower, that may be a very difficult thing to do, to put the antenna analyzer, a great big piece of bench test equipment, up at the top of a 300-foot tower. However, for you to carry, for you to hand into the pocket of the antenna rigger a Cal kit, which consists of a short circuit, an open circuit, and a dummy load, and these could be one-inch long devices with the adapter connector on the end of them, so to speak, and you tell the rigger to climb the tower And by way of the handy-talkie, you tell him, okay, connect the short circuit now, connect the open circuit now, and connect the dummy load now, while you're going through the calibration procedure down in the shack, so to speak. You could teach your vector network analyzer all of the characteristics of that particular transmission line that's going up that 300-foot tower. Therefore, once your vector network analyzer has been properly calibrated in that manner, and the rigger reconnects the real antenna at the top of the tower, you sit in the shack and make measurements, and now you have translated all of those measurements electronically by way of that calibration procedure all the way up to the top of the tower. Now you know the true impedance of that great big broadcast antenna, which is 25 feet tall, as if you were connecting it directly to the front panel of that vector network analyzer. I think you see the value of having a good calibration kit. So the other approach to this one, Mel, would be to make up a number of devices, a good dummy load for 50 ohms, 75 ohms, 25 ohms, if you like, a short and an open, or a fixed amount of capacitance. Put that on your antenna analyzer as a method of measurement.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Now, really high performance calibration kits made by the Mori company in California, they're kind of pricey. I'm a little bit surprised that the people that sell antenna analyzers do not sell a calibration kit. For them to give you a BNC connector with a short circuit inside, a BNC connector with an open circuit inside, and a BNC connector with a reasonably high performance 50-ohm resistor inside would be very easy for them to do. And therefore, you could be testing out your instrument, and the fact that that's not being sold with their antenna analyzers is a little bit surprising to me. You might have a comment on that one, Mel, and then we're going to go over to Wesley. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, exactly. If you look in the antenna manual, ARRL antenna manual, they show you how to construct those little devices for instance, if you want to calibrate a noise bridge. A number of articles have been written how to, you know, make the little calibrating elements up. But no, you don't get anything like that in the box with a handheld analyzer. And I know there is some questioning, you know, what you can expect out of them. But I think most of them will put you close enough into the ballpark, especially if you use it correctly. Ideally, you can use the antenna analyzer hooked to the tuner, which is hooked to the antenna, and do your adjustments of your tuner that way, so that when you put it to the rig, you don't have to get very nervous that you have to have a key down condition and damaging maybe the radio, or the radio now is because the SWR is pushing back the power and you're going crazy. Know, trying to determine where the adjustments are on your tuner. Let me properly use these antenna analyzers will do the job, I think, sufficiently for most of the hams. Getting into things like, you know, looking and using a lot of these new sophisticated instruments, looking at S parameters and all, I think it's a little bit overboard right now for many, of course, most beginners and maybe even some amateurs that have been around for a while, so I think it's a little bit new yet, looking at things like that, and well, I'm sure we'll see and hear more of that in the future, especially software-defined radios seem to be able to cover a lot of different territory now that we're getting more and more into computerized, you know, transceivers and all. All right, pick up Paul. I think he has a space report, and then we can go on. K2RIW in the TechNet. This is K2KEY.
I also have a question. W2TJT.
Okay, we've got both Joe and TJT in that order with comments. Joe, W2RYY, go right ahead.
The only problem with handing an antenna rig are precision elements to have him throw in his bag and bring up to the top of the tower. You take a chance of him knocking them together with the rest of his stuff and throwing them out of calibration.
Okay, if you had to hire an antenna tuner, a rigger, who's really a gorilla, and he destroys things, that's your problem. Can you give him the proper instruction to treat them with tender, loving care? Can you put those precision elements into a small box that he opens up when he gets to the top of the tower, connects them, and puts them back in the box? There's ways around that. With training, I think it could be done. But yes, like everything else, you've got to be kind of careful. Thomas, W2TJT, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Good evening. Hey, Mel, and all that's out there. This is Whiskey 2 Tango, Julia Tango, Tom, and I am mobile in Brooklyn right now. I have a question related to antennas. I have a couple of UHF and VHF antennas that I want to bring to a frequency that I could use. Some are more in the marine band. I've taken them apart. I've actually slid the internal works of the antenna out of the fiberglass radome. I've had a friend work on one of them for me, and he said he swept the antenna to bring it to the frequency, to bring it to a resonance frequency that I could use. He didn't explain how he did it. That's what I'm looking to know. I'm looking to find out how do I sweep an antenna, and what equipment would I need for that. Back to you, Dick. This is W2TJT.
Tom, you and I have led each other astray. I thought you were asking for a comment on the subject that's on the table at this time. There's a list of three people that are ahead of you, and I can't go out of order to go to your question, which is on a different subject. If you're willing to hang in there, Tom, we will get to you after these other people. The next person on our list was John, KC2WGB. John? Oh, wait a minute. I skipped over Wesley. Oh, Wesley, we're going to go to you for a 10-minute period of time now, then we're going to come back. And by the way, if anyone has been listening during the week, Wesley, John, and others have had quite a significant number of conversations as to what is real energy transfer, where is work really being done, where is energy being transferred. And these are subjects that are quite easily misunderstood by a significant number of people of a technical background. Wesley is trying to do some fairly exact measurements as to what energy is going in and what energy is coming out of his Tesla-like machines as well as other machines. And as such, a good definition of what is work, what is energy, is a very valid subject for people that are involved in that particular area of technology. Let me drop. So as I said, a number of discussions have occurred on that subject. I was a little bit unhappy to hear that sometimes people got a little bit caustic with each other. A person would come along and say, I know the answer. You guys must agree with me or you're wrong. Well, that's a bit severe. We're all in the learning curve. We got to treat each other with a little bit more respect. Every single person makes a certain errors. Nobody bats 1,000. My most firmly held beliefs, whether it be a function of my understanding of Mother Nature, physics, faith, whatever. Occasionally there's errors there. And if you're a realistic person, you laugh at the fact that you make some errors, accept the fact you're going to occasionally make some errors, accept the fact that somebody's going to point it out to you, and you'll eventually be corrected. That's the realistic way of doing things. So every one of us, when it comes to these concepts, can easily get it wrong. We should be a little bit friendly with each other, in my opinion. But here's just two or three sentences on what I think is a basic factor along these lines. Assume I've got a great big heavy chunk of wood, and it's sitting on a wooden floor. And I start pushing on the chunk of wood, and I slide it across the floor. Maybe it's a 50-pound chunk of wood. It's a great big cube of wood, and I push on it, and I slide it across the floor. Because I'm applying a force, moving it through a certain distance, I may apply 20 pounds of force. I may move it through 10 feet of distance, and you could call the 20 times the 10, 200 foot-pounds of energy I have put into that system. I've done the work at a certain rate of applying 20 pounds through some number of feet per second. I could convert that into horsepower if you like, or watts per second, or joules per second. There's various units you can use. And as the wood slides across the floor, the friction means that a certain amount of heat is being generated. And so the majority of the work that I put into the block of wood turns into heat as friction on that floor between the floor and the block, and it is a calculatable situation. Correspondingly, if I push against the wall, and if the wall doesn't move, because I've applied a force, but there is no distance through that force has moved through, I have done no work on the wall. However, the human being itself is not a 100% efficient machine. If you and I are sitting there doing absolutely nothing, we are continuously consuming energy in order to stay alive. Our breathing and our blood flow, everything is running. We're doing metabolism in order to have the energy in the body to give it the ability to move the muscles, to keep the brain working, and so on. So all kinds of energy is being dissipated into a human being, even though he is or isn't doing work. And in the process of me pushing against the wall, yeah, there's an increase in the amount of energy consumption, the amount of calories I'm metabolizing while I do that. That's just something about the way the tendons and the muscles...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's something about the way a human being works. There's all kinds of energy being dissipated in the joints, the muscles, the tendons, and so on. They're being stretched, and the body is working harder, so to speak, in the process of pushing against the wall. But no useful work on the wall takes place if the wall truly didn't move. So there you've got a kind of a conflict of terms of is energy dissipated in the human being, and where did it go? Well, it didn't go to the wall. It compressed my hand. It heated up the muscles in my arm. It maybe heated up the joint that I compressed on my elbow, and so on. All kinds of complicated things took place in the human being. When it comes to measuring a machine, you got to kind of make sure when it comes to electronics that you're really measuring with the right units and the right kind of instrumentation. If I'm measuring current and voltage going into a machine, and if the current is anything but a pure DC current, I've got to kind of make sure that I'm using a true RMS ammeter, a true RMS voltmeter, if I have anything but a steady state voltage. Because if I'm using a simple meter movement, which is an averaging device, not a true RMS device, you come up with some very significant errors. That's a little bit of a thumbnail sketch. So you guys have started to set quite a series of interesting conversations over the last couple of weeks, Wesley, on the instrumentation you're gathering, the measurements you're starting to make, and the definition of those measurements. And we're getting down to the real bedrock here of how do you define energy, work, and force, and distance, and foot-pounds, and poundles, and joules, and ergs, and whatever, in 2XJN, what's the latest in Queens, at the laboratory, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Wesley. Wait for the beep in a couple of seconds.
Yeah, in 2XJN, thank you very much for the microphone. Thank you for mentioning the discussion that we have had, and it brought a significant amount of people to the discussion. We had one very much opposing person, and a few undecided, and one who was actually trying logically to do not take a side, but very much scientifically find out what is true, what is not, and that was Glenn. Now, what I didn't like about the discussion that when we pick up the subject of a person having a horizontal his hand up on the ear and holding 10 pounds weight on it, and we were talking about the energy, and the person said that no work is being done, but the human body is not a perfect one, so this is not a good example. I'm willing to donate my time to John, who would be able better to explain what we were discussing about, because I believe it's a fascinating subject. So if you don't mind, John, pick up.
You got it, John.
Good evening, Dick. everyone on the net. We got a little misunderstood in this discussion. It was a very simple test to find out the amount of energy that a magnet was putting out, actually, the output energy of this magnet. So the idea was a fulcrum with a lever on it, the 10-to-1 ratio. And I understand that when it's suspended, no work is being done. I understand that only when we have force and distance do we have work. But my claim was we had a little solenoid on the lever which would lift the magnet. Of course, that's work being done. But I wanted to hold it at a height of 3 inches above the bench, which I did. And it would take, say, 30 milliamps to hold this 10-pound magnet up. The reason we picked 3 inches, or I picked 3 inches, is because these two very large magnets will maintain an air gap of roughly 3 inches. And this investigation was due to the fact that I had two opposing magnets on a track. One was on the bench and one was on a vertical track. Let me let it drop. And I had a veneer height gauge, and I had a little cam running, and it operated the magnet in an up and down pulsing 10,080 times. It was almost a 1 second pulse. I could measure no difference in the height. It would return to the same height each time. So looking into the amount of energy that the magnet was generating with its magnetic field, I just wanted to monitor the amount of current needed to hold it at that 3-inch height after it had been moved up either manually or with the solenoid. It negating, eliminating the losses in the coil and accounting for all of that, it took a few milliamps to hold it at 3 inches. Okay, we could figure out what that energy is. And I do realize that we could do it with weights. And instead of a solenoid coil, we could just put a bag and fill it with sand grains and eventually hold it at 3 inches. No work is being done when it's held there. But I was looking into the energy factors of the magnet. That's what the conversation was about. It got a little confused, and some people didn't understand what I meant. So I don't know if that's descriptive enough for you, but if you need more, I'll tell you.
Yeah, there's one ambiguity I've got here, Sean, which you can clear up real fast. If the two magnets were adjusted in such a way that they're opposing each other, a pair of north poles facing each other or a pair of south poles facing each other, and therefore the magnets, in theory, want to be at an infinite distance, and you have forced them with a lever mechanism and weights and whatever to be 3 inches apart by pushing on them, that would be a completely stable system. If you did it in the opposite direction, where the two magnets are opposite in polarity, a north is looking at a south, and they want to attract each other instead of pushing against each other, now you've got a partially unstable condition. You may require 3 pounds of force to hold them 3 inches apart, but if something disturbs that system where they become a little bit closer together, and magnets probably follow something close to an inverse square law, a little bit closer in spacing of two magnets of opposite polarity will attract each other much stronger, and all of a sudden it gets sucked down all the way, or vice versa. If it gets pushed away a little bit, it'll go all the way further away, so to speak. So if they were attracting each other, it's a partially unstable system, and it's a little bit difficult to make the measurement. If it's a opposing magnets, a pair of norths looking at each other where they're pushing away, that's a stable system, and now it becomes easier to make the measurements. And then you said you did something 1,080 times. There I'm not quite sure what took place. Back to you, John. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for a couple of seconds.
Yes, Dick. This was two horseshoe magnets set on a vertical track, one on the bench and one on the vertical track. They were set with opposing poles. These are very large magnets. It takes approximately 75 pounds to try to push them together. The cam was not holding them at 3 inches. That was their suspended free space with nothing touching. They would hold 3 inches apart. The cam was only used to pulse it up and down 10,080 times. and it always returned to the exact same height on the veneer height gauge.
Okay, interesting test. Now I'm going to make a guess, and I might not be right. Assuming there was no hysteresis loss within the magnets, when you do push them together, you're doing a partial degaussing of the surface of the magnets, and a slight change in the magnetic field takes place. If I had a very tiny Hall effect device connected to a Gauss meter, and I connect that Hall effect device right at the face of one of the horseshoe magnets, and I measure the magnetic field there, and then I push another magnet with opposing magnetic fields, in other words, north to north, south to south, push them together, my Hall effect device would see a slight decrease. Locally, right at that surface, I'm changing the magnetic field, depending on the rate at which I'm doing it, depending on the whether or not the magnet is made out of laminations or ferrite, or whether or not it's a solid chunk of metallic conductor, you're getting some hysteresis loss. But negating that, if you did it slow enough so the hysteresis losses are not significant, it's my guess that when you push two magnets together, you exert a certain amount of force to a certain distance, you have created a certain amount of potential energy, a little bit like compressing a spring. Whether I'm compressing a spring or pushing two magnets together, there's a degree of similarity there. There's a spring constant in the spring. In other words, each inch is going to increase the amount of force required to compress the spring by some number of pounds. So I could talk about the spring constant in foot-pounds per inch, pounds per inch, and by the same token, there's something somewhat similar I can do with a magnet. In the case of compressing a spring, when I go down, I'm giving it some extra energy, stored energy in the compressed spring. When I come back out of that compression, when I come back out of that compression, it gives me almost the exact same amount of energy back if it's an efficient spring and I'm not getting a whole lot of heating. Every real spring, when you deflect it, gives you a tiny amount of heating, which you could measure with a calorimeter if you wanted to. So if there was any real loss between the energy going in and coming back out, in the case of a spring, you can account for it. In the case of a magnet, if there's any loss pushing it down and letting it come back, again, you could measure the energy going in, the energy coming back out, and if there was loss, the hysteresis loss from the change in the magnetic field at the surface of the magnet is my first guess as to what kind of explanation you would have for where the energy was lost. And if you did it slow enough, I think the energy loss could be very, very small.
Comment.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, first, you cannot compare it with spring because the spring is one steady molecular structure, as with the magnet, we're dealing with two different molecular structures that are apart. At second, no heat is being produced in this area. At third, I have RFL 912 Gauss meter in here, and I took two neodymium magnets and I put them into the glass tube, and with the pencil I was pushing them a number of times. I didn't count how many, 2,000, 3,000 times. The Gauss meter shows me always the same amount of magnetic energy when the magnet returns to the proper to the set position. So I don't believe that the comparison to the spring is very much accurate.
One quick question, Wesley. When you push the magnets together, did you see a change in the reading on the Gauss meter?
Only to the point where the probe of the Gauss meter was put on the certain position, so it's fixed. It wasn't holding in the hand, and when the magnet was pushed, then there was a change of the magnetic field, and of course it shows on the Gauss meter. But when it returns the previous position, it shows exactly, accurately, the same numbers. And no matter how many times I did that, it always was the same. Now, so, could you respond?